There is an ancient Greek myth about a beautiful goddess who came to Earth offering to marry any man who could defeat her in a foot race. The only catch in the deal was that any competitor who lost against her would have to die. And she was very fast. But men who were enthralled with her beauty agreed to the races, and they were held one after the other. Sometimes she would tease, and she would start off slowly and allow them to get some distance ahead, but then she would quickly catch up, sometimes even turn around and wait for them. But always, always, she was the first to the finish line, and they were executed. Until eventually there was no one left that was willing to try to compete, no matter how great her beauty or how supernatural her powers. Except one. There was one young man who scheduled the race and several days before went to a goldsmith and had crafted three magnificent gold apples. He kept it a secret and hid them in his clothing as he came to the starting line that day of the race. And it began as the other races had, with her quickly moving into the distance. She was fast, amazingly fleet-footed. She did what she had done in all of the races before, something that he had observed. When she would get almost out of sight, she would pause long enough to turn around and to look back to see where her competitor was running. And when she did, he took that instant of opportunity, reached in and took out one of the golden apples and threw it high into the sky where it glistened in the sun and caught her attention before going off into a grassy field that was nearby. She was intrigued by it. She knew she had plenty of time and she was fast enough to catch up, so she doubled back and went out in the field where it was easy to find the apple as it reflected the sun's light. She picked it up, examined it, and it was magnificent. And then looked back to the track where he had not only caught up, but where he was almost out of sight. And so she quickly ran, and it took no time at all that she passed him, and with a giggle in her voice, she again ran the entire distance ahead until almost out of sight, when she again turned back. And a second time, he threw a second apple high into the sky. It caught her attention, and it went off into a field on the other side of the road. And so she repeated the whole procedure again. She doubled back, she went, and she found it. He got ahead, but she caught up. And a third time, nearing the finish line, she looked back, calculating the distance, how far she had to go, and how far behind he was. When, knowing that his life was at stake, he reached and grabbed the third apple, threw it as high as he possibly could, and as far away into a nearby grassy field. Knowing the beauty of the other apples, and still intrigued by this whole new procedure, she left the course, ran as fast as she could back, picked up the third apple, and went back to the track where he was nearing the finish line. She ran faster than anyone had ever run before, but he beat her. He made it there first, not because he was faster on foot, but because she could not resist the temptation of the golden apples. Now, it was another writer, also ancient, and also writing in Greek, his name James, who wrote on the same subject in James 1, verses 13 to 15. It's on page 1881. He wrote that when tempted, no one should say, "God is tempting me," for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. For each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Here, in explaining how sin comes from temptation, James says that the first step in it all is refusing responsibility. That when tempted, no one should say that God is tempting me, or God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. You see, it all goes back to the Garden of Eden. For there in God's perfect creation, he placed only one limitation. He told Adam and Eve that they could and they should enjoy everything that God and his genius and creativity had made, with the single exception of the fruit of one tree, called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for he warned that that was deadly fruit from a deadly tree. But after they decided to sin and they ate the fruit, God came and he confronted them. And they acknowledged what they had done. And Adam answered as creatively as a new sinner could. And he said to God that it is the woman that you put here with me. She's the one who gave me the fruit of that tree and I ate it. Now it's not the least bit unusual for a man to blame his wife for the things that he has done wrong. But in this particular case, he was really blaming God. He was saying that it is because God had put Eve there with him that all of this happened. And if God had not set him up for this kind of sin, it in fact would not have happened. And therefore, God was the one who was responsible. And Eve, while different in her answer, communicated much the same thing. She said, it's the serpent who lied to me. That's why I ate it. And so our foreparents established a tradition which has wound its way down through humankind ever since. And that is refusal to accept responsibility for human misbehavior. For since then, we have all been very prone to make up excuses, actually to believe those excuses, and to blame others, especially to blame God. Failing to understand that God is the absolute opposite of evil. God isn't even tempted by it. God so hates that which is wrong that it shows not the least of enticement to him. In fact, God so hates sin that he's quite incapable of ever setting us up so that we could do it because he is so opposed to anyone participating in such a thing. So we need to understand that when we misbehave, when we do that which is inappropriate, when we sin, that we are responsible for our behavior. Oh, it's true that other people do things that affect us. It's true that God did create Eve as Adam's companion. It's true that the serpent did lie to Eve, and that was connected to what she did. But that Adam and Eve were themselves responsible for the response they had to the situation they faced and for the decisions that they made. Now, it seems to me, if ever there was a time when this teaching from God fits, it is today in America. Because as lots of people have observed, we have become a nation of self-declared victims, where whatever is wrong in our lives, we attribute to someone else. It is because of what someone else has done that we have gone wrong. And so we are quick to blame our parents and our schools, to blame churches, to blame government especially, to blame relationships that we have with other people, our families, and are extremely slow to accept the responsibility ourselves. We need to someday admit that the reason that we steal is not because somebody else left the money on the table. The reason that we lust is not because of the way another person looks. The reason that we are greedy and want more and more is not because of the ads that are on television, the billboards, or in the magazines. The reason we do what we do is because of ourselves. That it's not God's fault and it's not somebody else's fault that we are tempted by evil. It is our fault. Whether it is a recovery program or becoming a Christian, the first step, the first essential step, is to admit that we are responsible for our behavior and not someone else. And unless we can get past blaming God or others, we are not far along in conquering any habit or becoming Christians. Not that temptation is sin, because it's not. But failure to accept responsibility is a first significant step in the progression from temptation to sin. The problem is when we respond positively to evil. The idea that James here communicates probably comes out of his background as a fisherman. And the idea is that a fish is swimming along in the lake going on its way when it notices over to the side a line with a lure on it. And the fish is tempted by the sparkle, by the attraction, by the appetite. And so the fish changes course and goes over and takes a bite and gets hooked. And it's not the line that draws the fish to the lure. It's the decision that the fish makes in responding positively to that evil. Or as James wrote it, each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. It's because we all have this inside problem. And that inside problem is evil desire. We have a kitten in our house that is fast becoming a full-grown cat, and her name is Carmen. One day, Carmen made an amazing discovery of something that no one told her about. She was a fairly little kitten at the time, and running around, she ran with great vigor to the top of the couch in our family room and glanced over and saw for the first time our 55-gallon aquarium with tropical fish. And she was enthralled and stayed there for the longest time with eyes wide open and not a single blink, watching those fish with a feline lust that wanted to gobble everyone down to the last fin. And then when she became big enough to make the leap, unfortunately we have glass on the top of the aquarium, she actually jumped up to the top of the aquarium where she just hangs over the side. And watches those fish. I think she would do it by the hour if we did not chase her away. Now, I don't know whether tropical fish think or not, but if I were a tropical fish swimming by and looking at this cat, I would think to myself how deeply grateful I am for glass. Because if it were not for the glass, it would be only a swift movement of the paw, and those fish would soon be consumed. For you see, deep down somehow in the makeup of a cat is a very strong desire for the fish. They're born with it. And as cats desire fish, so humans desire evil. We're born that way. Now, it's a fortunate thing that we have laws and we have rules that are part of society. I count them as gifts from God that are like the glass that keeps us away from doing all the things that we are interested in doing. I sometimes hear a debate, actually I hear it frequently, where people say, are things worse today than they were 25 years ago? Is there more crime, or do we just hear more about it? Is it just because the word is out, or in fact, are people doing far worse things than they ever did before? And more than that, are people worse people today in 1994 than they were in, say, 1964 or 1934? The answer is that people are not worse today than they were then, although it may be that there are a lot of places in the glass of society that are cracking, which enable us to get our paws through and do the things of evil desire, which were not previously possible. For those who would like to stop temptation from turning into sin, it is important to understand that responding positively to evil is a tragic second step. So you pick a temptation. Go ahead, pick any temptation. If I respond positively to that temptation, then I become like a fish that has changed its course and is swimming for the lure and considering at least biting onto the hook. I've taken a second step in turning temptation into sin. But what would you say is exactly the moment, the second on the clock, when temptation that is not sin becomes sin? When does sin become sin? Well, according to James 1:15, it's when we decide to do it. It is then, after desire has conceived, that it gives birth to sin. So let's take income tax as an example. It's coming up on that season of the year when people especially complain that the taxes are too high and they wonder about ways of reducing them. And the idea crops up one day, or it may be suggested by somebody else, that you shouldn't report cash income because there's no paper trail. There's no 1099 or W-2. There's really no way for the government ever to know that you receive this money that's purely cash. So if you don't report it, if you're in the 15% federal bracket or the 28% federal bracket, for every $100 of cash income that you don't report, you can save $15 or $28 or perhaps even more. And then there's another thing you could do. You could increase your claim on charitable contributions. In fact, without giving anything at all, it's possible to write down that deduction, because around the 1st of April, there are a lot of lists that are published in a lot of places that tell you by your income category approximately what would be a normal charitable deduction. And if you put that down, the chances are minuscule that you'll ever be audited, because as long as you stay within the range that doesn't trigger an IRS audit, you're probably okay. Or you may be tempted with the idea of claiming a vacation trip as a business trip. In that case, you have all the receipts. You have the airline ticket receipts, you have the hotel, and maybe even the meal receipts. And you can rationalize it as well. You think to yourself, yeah, you know, there was a Wednesday afternoon on the beach when I remember thinking about the office. So, I mean, technically, it really was a business trip because I did business while I was there. Now, that's all temptation. But that's not sin. It's not sin to hear about the idea or to think about the idea, but it becomes sin at the moment a decision is made to do it. In other words, we don't have to actually do it for it to be a sin. The analogy that James uses here compares the conception and the birth of a baby, so that a baby doesn't have to be born to be a baby. Once a baby is conceived, it is real, it is fully human, as if it has been born. And so when a temptation has been conceived and that a decision has been made that I'm going to go for it, then it has become a sin, even though it may be a sin that is not yet born. For example, a man may be tempted to sexual sin with a woman that he sees and he likes and is attracted to. That is temptation. And then at some specific moment, he decides he's going to go for her. Except the glass comes up, she refuses him, or the risk of being found out, of it costing a job or a marriage or a family or money. Somehow the glass of society comes up and he is stopped from doing what he has lusted to do and decided to do, and therefore it doesn't actually happen. Is it then sin? You bet it is. That's why Jesus taught that someone who lusts in his or her heart is guilty of adultery. That someone who hates in his or her head and decides to kill someone else is guilty of murder. That if the plans don't work out, that does not make it any less sin as far as God is concerned. So we have here powerful, significant teachings from God in the Bible for us. But we have to be careful that we don't take these teachings and do something truly stupid with them, which I think sometimes people do. For there are some people who stretch the Bible's teaching to say that it doesn't make any difference whether a person actually commits a crime or not, because they are just as guilty if they decided to do it. Now, that may be true in terms of offending God. God is offended, and it is a sin against God once we've decided to do what we're tempted to do, whether we can pull it off or not. But that is not true as far as community standards and criminal law are concerned. For example, if you decide tomorrow morning that you need some money and the place they seem to keep it is at a bank, and so you decide that you're going to give in to the temptation, you're going to go ahead and rob a bank tomorrow, and so you get your gun and your car is full of gas and you have everything worked out and you have your blindfold on, you know, but you get the wrong address. And so you get there and it's an empty lot. So you didn't pull it off. As far as community standards and community life is concerned, as far as criminal law is concerned, you have not, in fact, robbed the bank, and you're not guilty of doing that. But as far as God is concerned, just because you got the wrong address doesn't make you or me any less guilty of doing it. If someone decides to have an affair with a coworker or a neighbor, and the liaison falls through, but the spouse of the person intending that affair finds out about it by some means or other, that does not then become grounds for divorce. So there is a distinction between offending God and something being a sin as far as God is concerned, and something being a breaking of the law in terms of human relationships. But what we tend to do in situations like that is act as if what is most important is criminal law and human relationships, and to somehow minimize the offense against God. But that's really what sin is. And it is far greater a tragedy to offend God and to sin against Him than it is against any criminal law or any community standard. We need to understand that sin is serious stuff. Sin is death in the making. As James wrote it, that after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Sin is deadly. Sin kills relationships. Sin destroys bodies. Sin wrecks lives. But most of all, sin offends God. And it kills our relationship with Him. Sometimes it's quick, but often it takes a long time. It's just like a baby that takes a long time to grow up. It's just like someone can smoke a cigarette today and it may not result in a lung disease for 30 years. Someone may get a virus today and feel just fine for quite a while, but it may spin out weeks or months or even decades later before the virus takes its toll. And so while some sin is quick, most sin takes time to destroy a life. But that doesn't mean that we should ever forget that sin is deadly stuff. Now, in case we haven't understood, all of this tells us that God is against sin. He's not against sin because He's against us. He's not against sin because He wants to put restrictions on us for arbitrary reasons. It's not because He wants to limit our happiness. It is because God has chosen to be known as a parent. And as any good parent must do, good parents have to warn children of dangers that they would not see for themselves, of consequences that are far down the road of life. And so God carefully warns us how temptation can turn into sin. It would be all bad news, though, if we are told that we have an evil desire with which we are born, and that evil desire draws us like a fish to the hook to sin. But there's good news. Good news that comes in Jesus Christ, who the night before He was to die, gathered up His best of friends, and they went and visited a garden together just outside the city of Jerusalem, a place called Gethsemane. It was to pray and to prepare, because Jesus knew that this was His last night. He did probably what any of us would do if we knew we were going to die the next day. He had the mixed emotions of wanting to be with His best friends and wanting to be alone to deal with what He faced. It was while He was alone that He prayed. He prayed as we would pray, for Himself. But He also prayed for His friends. And then He did a startling thing. He interrupted His prayers to go and to give to them some final advice. You know, they say that the last words that a person consciously speaks before dying are often counted to have an extraordinary weight, far more than all of the words that have otherwise been spoken in a person's lifetime. And so it must have been very important to Jesus to speak what He knew would be counted as among His very last words to His very best friends. And He said to them, "Watch and pray, so that you will not fall into temptation." Good advice. Practical advice. To watch and to pray. Pick a temptation again. Just one. Or, I don't know, make it a short list of two or three. What would you say in this week now just begun would be the temptation that is most likely to hook you? What's the one that, you know, you can almost feel it drawing you right now, and you might make that progression to actually do it? Now, apply Jesus' advice to that temptation. And first of all, just watch out. Just be on constant guard and avoid biting the hook. So if the temptation to lose your temper, then look for the times that's going to happen. And bite your tongue or count to 10 or close your mouth. Just be ready. Or it's lust. You say, you know, where I work, what's going on? I just find that that's what's filling my mind most of the time. Well, watch out and don't take a second look. Or maybe it's greed. Maybe over and over you just want more and you want what everybody else has. So watch out for that. And sort of get ready by saying, instead of getting, I can think about ways of giving. But be sure to add the second piece of Jesus' advice, and that is to pray. So in a daily routine of prayer, actually do it. Say, God, the issue with me is that I lose my temper. The issue with me is that I'm just thinking these sexual thoughts and wanting to do it just constantly. The issue with me is I'm such a greedy person. I want what everybody else has. The issue with me is, and God, I ask that you will help me, that you will give to me the strength, that you will give to me the discipline, that you will help and put up the glass so that temptation in my life will not turn to sin that hurts you, God, in your life. Take the advice of Jesus to watch and to pray. Father, will you do that for us? Every one of us right now has thought of the temptation, and there's something slippery even about the thought of it. For just getting it into our minds sort of makes it attractive, and we sort of slide in the way of doing that which is wrong. Instead, Lord, help us to keep up our guard, to watch out of the turning of temptation into sin. And we pray that by your Spirit, you will strengthen and protect us, that we may do that which is good, not that which is bad, what is right, not what is wrong, that the temptation may be stopped, and that you may be pleased, for Jesus' sake.
We welcome as our faith story guest this morning, Mark Salden. As with all of us, hardships come our way and intersects with life's experiences. And Mark comes to share about those experiences and how God has met him along the way. So welcome, Mark.
I grew up in a family at a time when your only value and worth was by your works. It was a system of high expectations. If you didn't meet those expectations, you failed. And if you failed, shame on you. You're worthless, no value, one big piece of junk. No matter how hard I tried, I just never felt good enough. So I came to a place where I quit trying. Instead, I sought negative attention. I became a problem kid. The only way to control a problem kid was by force and shame. I went to a religious grade school, and again, I didn't feel I measured up. So my views on Christians and God became real warped. God was this demanding father who was just waiting for me to screw up, so he could punish me and make me pay for being so flawed and not worthy of his love or grace. Grace, what was that? I had a teacher by the name of Grace, but regular grace, that was beyond my comprehension. God and Jesus were more like the president to me than a higher power. I could recognize their picture, but I totally lost my personal relationship with them. I never was fully able to understand the reason for God's son Jesus coming here to die for us on the cross. I thought he was just waiting for me to screw up also. I struggled through life with grace, with no grace or forgiveness for the next 35 years. I always have said I went to the school of hard knocks. There was a general contracting and remodeling business that failed due to dishonesty from a client, financial hardship, a divorce 11 years ago, loneliness, and the hard-to-accept fact of not living with my three daughters, alcohol abuse, bordering on alcoholism, suicidal thoughts and attempts, deterioration of my own values, overeating, and Lord, self-esteem. It may seem like an understatement, but I obviously didn't like myself. Still, I had a nope, not yet attitude. I'm tough. I don't need anyone, especially God. I'll just work a little harder, faster, and longer. I still recognized that picture of Jesus, but I still didn't need him. About this time, I had an opportunity to start remodeling retail stores and malls. I took the great escape and traveled for 9 years until I burned out. I woke up in my motel room one morning so depressed I couldn't even get out of bed. I was recalling all of my unhappiness since childhood. I decided to get some professional help with my depression through therapy and medication. Still, I had a nope, not yet attitude. I still didn't really need God or his son. But I had tried everything else, and it got me nowhere. A friend of mine sings in the Wooddale Church Choir. He's invited me to the church's Christmas concerts the last 3 years. I came and watched. But I still felt I wasn't good enough for God. But then, 1 year ago last spring, I went on retreat with the Wooddale Church's Wednesday night divorce recovery group called Uplifters, founded by the late Bob Canzora, whom I respected a great deal. At the retreat, I was talking to a now dear friend, but a complete stranger at the time, about how I felt like I could never be good enough for God to like, love, or accept me. And she said that I would never be good enough, but that God still loves me unconditionally. She got me thinking for the next couple of months about that picture of Jesus that I recognized from a distance. As a child, I accepted that God existed, but later in life, I became agnostic. But through the 12-step program, I began an 11-year journey back to the Lord, whom I simply called my higher power at the time. I believe that God wanted me to have a more personal relationship with him. I then made an appointment with Pastor Joel Johnson. I didn't show up for two of the appointments. I was afraid. But finally, I showed up for the third one. He showed me the simple little booklet that explained that Jesus is the bridge between God our Father and us. It finally made sense. A light bulb finally went off. Nope, I don't have to earn it. I just simply had to receive his free gift of salvation. I couldn't reach him through my own works. So in Joel's office, I confessed my sins and asked Jesus to come into my heart and life. It was suggested that I get baptized. The only problem was that they scheduled me 3 times before I finally had the courage to show up and go through with it. It's been a process of growth since then. But I've had a lot of help from my friends, church staff, and the prayer ministry team. Their prayers have really helped me move on positively with my new life. Wooddale is the first church I've ever been a member of. I'm grateful that God has given me a non-shaming place to grow. I'm planning to go back to school in the fall, not the U of Hard Knocks, but into a field called non-destructive testing, unless the Lord moves me in other directions. My relationship with my mother, sister, and daughters have gone through a lot of growth as well. There has been forgiveness and healing on both sides over the past year. Yes, I really do need God and his son, Jesus Christ, and the offer of salvation and forgiveness by grace and not by works. Nope, God doesn't make junk, we do. Oh, remember that picture I recognized? I no longer need it because Jesus indwells within me through the power of the Holy Spirit. Thank you.
Madam Parker speaking.
Hi, Miss Parker. This is Brad in accounting. I was wondering if you had a minute.
Well, Brad, I'm expecting a conference call right now.
I just had a few questions about your expense reports. Well, it's certainly not urgent, and you can call me back at your convenience.
No, let's get this out of the way now. If my call comes through, I'll just pick it up, that's all.
Terrific. All right, as I said, this is completely routine.
I understand. Listen, I'm going to put you on speakerphone.
I have your expense report from the November trip to Florida here. And, well, I can't help but notice that you charged back 2 airline tickets to your travel account.
Yes, my assistant Jennifer accompanied me on that trip.
Well, I do have a separate charge for Jennifer right here on her expense account. The second ticket on your account is, oh, well, it looks like it's in your husband's name. Now, I'm sure that you've already reimbursed the company for the purchase of that ticket.
Oh, yes. I do remember now, yes, my husband did travel with me, and I do remember submitting that reimbursement check to accounting.
Well, I'll look around here because the ledger just doesn't show the credit yet. But I wouldn't worry about it. It'll turn up soon. Maybe it was even returned to you by the mailroom. Sometimes people reuse inter-office envelopes addressed to themselves but forget to address it to the next person. Then the envelope comes right back to them when they mail it.
Well, would you look at that? The envelope is sitting right here on my desk. There it is, Marilyn Parker. Boy, do I feel silly. I'll get that check back to you right now, Brad.
I wish all the follow-up calls were this easy. Now, the next item on the list is your mileage reimbursement to the airport.
Yes, I drove my car to the airport and then parked my car.
I'm sure you were just in a super rush to fill out the paperwork, but it does look like there might have been some numbers transposed here.
How's that, Brad?
Well, for the mileage reimbursement, it looks like you calculated the rate at 52 cents a mile, but our standard is actually 25 cents a mile.
I'll just have to speak to my secretary about that. There's just no excuse for such sloppy calculations.
No, I can't be sure, but this expense report was handwritten with your signature on it.
You know, Brad, Jennifer just came in to let me know that my conference call is ready. If we could perhaps talk about this later.
No problem, Miss Parker. I look forward to talking with you about your long-distance telephone bill, too. Have a nice day now.